So we are looking at the study of the Gospel of John, and we are in chapter 4, and that is following on the conclusion or the wrapping up of the woman at the well and the details that are part of that picture. But it's going to be dealing with another sign that the book is focused on in many ways. And so we want to think about that. But I want to start with a question that is very practical. And that is, do you ever get discouraged by the circumstances around you? Now, we just had discussion in our Sunday school class about things that are going on around us that are rather discouraging. In the moral and political realm, and that can be rather overwhelming. And so there are plenty of reasons that we could come up with why we could be discouraged in these days. So let me ask another question. Have you ever had serious concerns for the well-being of someone close to you? Now, that's another dimension of an area of concern that we have when someone close to us is ill or has major problems or something of that nature. And if you've ever had someone close to you who is perilously ill, that can be very disturbing, and it can leave one feeling helpless and fearful. And you may have found yourself in that position before. But does it compel you to try to do just about anything to help them? I think that's often the case. And you may want to consider, well, to what extent would you go to help someone that you loved? Well, we were in Colorado this past week, and at a particular intersection, a couple of times we saw some people with signs asking for donations to help a child in serious need. They were willing to go to the length to stand out there with signs asking for donations to help this child. We assume it was legitimate, but that is something that someone would do. In a situation like that. So our text today illustrates the extent to which someone was willing to go to get help for a seriously ill and dying child. And if you've ever been in a situation like that or have lost a loved one close to you under difficult circumstances, you can probably relate more than you wish to. We can understand that. So we want to think about as we look at the text and thinking about what we have looked at already in the book of John and have seen various places where John is trying to communicate reasons why people ought to be responsive to Christ, to receive him, to be accepting of him. And so we want to look at a context for positive reception. Looking at verses 43 to 45, we read, "Now after the 2 days, he departed from there and went to Galilee." And you have to think back to what 2 days we're talking about. The previous passage was talking about him staying in Samaria where he had been ministering to the people that had come after the woman at the well had gone back to Samaria to testify to the men there. "For Jesus himself testified that a prophet has no honor in his own country. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things he did in Jerusalem at the feast, for they also had gone to the feast." So I don't know about you, but if you look at that carefully, verse 44 seems to be a little bit incongruous to the context. So we want to think about that. What are we talking about here? So that's something you can have worked out in a corner of your mind while we're continuing. So some contexts are more or less open to reception. We find that in our own experience when we deal with people. There are some places, some situations where there's greater openness to the things of the Lord and some where there are less. And this is sort of in the background of what is going on here as well. John was rather intentional in including details of time and place. There is some specificity that is included here and there. So it's pointing out that Jesus continued to move north. He's back in Galilee, having come up from a more southern area, moving up from Samaria up to the Galilee region. That would be near the Sea of Galilee that we can understand and relate to. And so John is sort of bridging the gap between the important events that are going on here and giving some transitional explanation as to how Jesus moved from one site to another, which he has done previously, like chapter 2, verse 12, 4, 1 to 3. And he typically focused on clusters of events in Jesus' ministry. And he kind of ties them together and then kind of moves from one place to another. And it's sort of, in this case, a completion of a cycle in Jesus' movements and somewhat of John's narrative on this as well. The 2 days that are in view here are those that Jesus spent ministering to the Samaritans, going back to verse 40. So he now resumed the trip that was referred to in verse 3, where we read, he left Judea and departed again to Galilee. But he made a detour through Samaria and spent some time there in order to witness to the Samaritans. And then we come to this matter of the placement of the statement about a prophet's honor, and I think it requires some consideration. So let's think about this for a moment. If a prophet has no honor in his own country, why did the Galileans welcome Jesus since Galilee was his homeland? So the word here that's translated his own country is patris, and it can either mean homeland or hometown, and the way the Synoptic Gospels tended to use it was to describe Nazareth. That's what it would be referring back to, like Matthew 13:57, Mark 6:4, Luke 2:24. So it's commonly identifying his country or his homeland area as Nazareth, even though he was born in Bethlehem. So there's a couple of different explanations. One is that John viewed Judea as Jesus' homeland, or possibly Jerusalem as his hometown, because Bethlehem is right close to there, within 5 miles. Perhaps John regarded Judea and Jerusalem as Jesus' spiritual homeland or hometown, since he was of David's spiritual heritage. And the Jews is a term that John used particularly of the Jews in Judea, but not exclusively. He frequently referred to Nazareth as Jesus' physical home. There are various passages where he has done that. And besides, Jesus did not choose where he ministered based on popular acceptance as to how he was received, but he did seek to avoid premature conflict with the religious leaders in Jerusalem. But the implication of verses 44 and 45 is that Jesus' honor was the determining factor. Was he honored in the same way? Also, the reception that Jesus received in Galilee was not entirely positive. And then there's a second explanation, that is that this word patris, translated country, refers to heaven. But this view does not explain why John included the proverb as an explanation for Jesus going into Galilee from Judea. So there's another explanation that I think may be a better way to look at it, and that is that the patris here, the country, refers to Galilee in contrast to Samaria rather than in contrast to Judea, because Jesus' own country was Jewish turf rather than Samaritan territory, because he was part of that area to the north of Samaria. And on the Jewish turf, Jesus had experienced significantly less honor than what he did among the Samaritans. And then the so or the therefore that begins verse 35 does not explain why Jesus went back into Jewish territory. He did not go back there because the Jews typically rejected him It rather introduces the reason for the Galileans' reception of him that follows. In other words, the people from the prophet's own country, the Galilean Jews, only received him because they had seen the miracles that he had done at the Passover in Jerusalem that was referenced earlier, and not because they honored him as a prophet. They had a reception, but it was sort of a surface kind of thing. And so what John is really doing here, he's contrasting the element of unbelief among the Jews. They were only enamored by what he had done, what they had seen him do, in contrast to the true belief of the Samaritans. And that probably, I think, is a better way of understanding that. Then coming to verse 46, So Jesus came again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine. This is back in chapter 2, the beginning of chapter 2. And there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. So this context provided opportunity for reception. That's what we're going to see as we continue looking at this passage. So Jesus came back to the city of Cana in Galilee. And you have a map presented there to give you a little bit of an idea of proximity of places and things. And so this incident sort of completes a cycle in John's gospel. John had performed his first recorded sign in John chapter 2, verse 1, in Cana. And now he returned and did another miracle there. So there's kind of a rhetorical device called an inclusio going on here. It's kind of like bookends, tying things together. And so there's even a second reference to Capernaum because that was referenced in the first account as well. So John's account of Jesus' first miracle in Cana ended with a reference to the weak faith of the Jews that rested only on miracles. And his account of Jesus' second miracle in Cana opens with a similar reference. So you can see some parallel things going on in terms of what he's communicating. Now, it's also been observed that the structure here seems to be significant. As we pointed out, it seems to be an inclusio here, or the bookends idea. It is framed by two miracles in Cana, with two conversations that take place in between them. Jesus' conversation with Nicodemus is typical of the reception that the Jews gave him. It was more skeptical than responsive. But his conversation with the Samaritan woman shows the reception that non-Jews typically gave him. They didn't have that same baggage. It seems that was kind of important. So we see these two attitudes toward Jesus that are communicated here, but we also see some of the same thing that took place in the book of Acts when you look at that and compare those who were of the Jewish background who were less than receptive and those who were of a Gentile background who were more receptive. And it's part of their faulty understanding of who Jesus was and maybe an element of skepticism that was there for anything that was not how they thought things should be. And Jesus definitely fit that picture. So then there's the center section that is the structural highlight, and it tells something of what Jesus' mission was. And this is in the form of what's referred to as a chiasm. It has that X picture. And so let's take a look at this. First of all, verses 1 through 11 of chapter 2, Jesus' first sign in Cana of Galilee. And then there's a reference to Capernaum, which was going to be Jesus' headquarters. We see there are many references back to that. That's kind of where he's working from, where the disciples also had a major part of their background. chapter 2, verse 12. And then there's hostility toward Jesus in Jerusalem, chapter 2, verses 13 to 25. Then there's Nicodemus's response to Jesus in 3, 1 to 15. And then the importance of Jesus' mission, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. That's the middle part here, John 3:16 through 36. And that's kind of the critical element here. And then notice the Samaritan woman's response, chapter 4, 1 through 38. That's a D prime. And then C prime, acceptance of Jesus in Samaria, 39 to 42. And then a reference to Galilee, the kind of the ministry arena of Jesus when he wasn't in Jerusalem. That's where he tended to be. And then there's a second sign in Cana, verses 46 to 54. So you can see there are parallels that stand out in the structure, and that's why it's referred to as both a chiasm and as an inclusio, because you have the sort of these bookends of the ministry in Galilee. Now, that's I think sometimes a helpful picture. You don't want to get lost in the details of structure, but sometimes structure is informative. And I think there's some interesting things to note here as well. So the passage here, it constitutes sort of a closing incident in John's account of Jesus' early public ministry. It's at chapters 2 through 4. So it's kind of tying it together, wrapping it up. Chapter 1 is more of an introductory nature. Chapters 2 through 4 is kind of identifying Jesus' early ministry. And it shows him returning to Cana. As you recall, that was Nathanael's hometown, chapter 21 of John, verse 2. And it shows where he performed another significant miracle. So that's, again, kind of setting some background to see what's going on here. So John evidently included these details to show Jesus' demonstration of his authority that resulted in some Jews believing on him. It's also been observed that both the miracles performed at Cana are shown to have been prompted by trust. Mary trusted her son to do something to relieve the embarrassment of their host at the wedding, when they had run out of wine. The father of the sick boy that we'll see was equally confident that Jesus would provide help, that he could get help from him. So there was, again, a trust, a belief, a trust factor was part of the picture. And both miracles are shown to have resulted in personal surrender to Jesus, which is what the expectation is for a believer. And his disciples believed on him after the water had been turned into wine, and the father and the rest of his household believed as a result of the healing of the boy. It sort of clarified and crystallized their understanding of things. And the terminology that's used here and the grammar illustrates it's a matter of putting their faith in him. It's a genuine trust thing. And also John's reference to Cana here and the first miracle seems intended to remind the reader of that event, because it was bringing it back up. He didn't have to bring it up here again, but he had. So it seems that this is rather intentional, sort of suggests a completion of a cycle that is communicated here. Then, thinking about the identity of the people involved here is somewhat limited in detail. We would like to know more about this nobleman that is referenced, or royal official, depending on which version you're looking at. Basilicus is the word. If you go by his title, it was a man who served a king, either in a civil capacity or in a military capacity. And the one who would have been viewed as a king at this time would have been Herod Antipas, in view of the context of where he lived, but Herod Antipas was not an official king, but he was popularly regarded as one, as noted in Mark 6:14. And it's assumed that this official, this nobleman, was probably Jewish, and some have speculated that maybe he was the one that was referred to in Luke 8:3, the one that's referenced as Chuza, who was a servant of Herod. But again, that's probably more speculation than anything else, but it's something that's thrown out from time to time. We know that Jesus also healed the servant of a Gentile centurion in Capernaum, but we know that was a different individual and it was a different occasion. So if you're thinking of that, try to keep those distinguished. An important feature of this sign was the significant distance between Jesus' location and Cana and where the official sons lay ill in Capernaum. That's going to be something of significance. The distance argues for a broader element of power that could only be explained by a divine intervention. And the idea is this is no insignificant healing event. It was something that needed to be recognized as such. So that brings us then to look at the next section here. And this is an urgent request for personal provision. When he heard that Jesus had come out of Judea in Galilee, he went to him and implored him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Now, we can identify with the pain in the heart of a parent in a situation like that. Then Jesus said to him, "Unless you people see signs and wonders, you will by no means believe." Now, was that the response that this individual was expecting? What are you looking for? A sign? Why did Jesus say that? What was he thinking? And this guy's desperate. So let's think about that. So there's the desperation at the prospect of death. That is not a surprising scenario. The royal official was desperately concerned for his son's life. He appealed to Jesus to make the 13-mile trip from Cana to Galilee to heal his son. So there's some sort of an acknowledgement here that he believed that Jesus could heal people, but there's no indication that he necessarily believed that Jesus was more than a healer. He at least recognized that much. When we look at some instances in the Talmud, there are various cases where there were those who were ill, even to the point of death, and they were restored by the prayers of particular celebrated rabbis. So maybe that was in the back of his mind. We don't know, but that is something to think about. So he may have thought, well, he was just one of those rabbis that had some powerful prayers, and maybe he could come and do something for him. Sometimes I think people today may have somewhat of a superstitious kind of mindset in that regard, where they think certain people have more potent prayers than others, and I would say don't be taken in by that kind of thinking. We know what James says, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. And it doesn't say you have to be a rabbi or anything else in order to do that. So do take that to heart as well. So he must have been sufficiently desperate to come to Jesus, to seek him, to ask him to come that distance. Now, you say 13 miles. That's not that far. You hop in your car and you zip over there and it's, you know, just a few minutes. Susan has come to realize that 13 miles is a lot further when you're on bicycle than it is when you're on a car. But she's doing really well, so we can appreciate that. But if you're walking, it tends to take a little while to get there. So it's noteworthy that Jesus' first sign came in response to a mother's request, but this second sign came in the response to a father's request. That may or may not have any major significance, but it's interesting to at least contemplate that. It seems that the nobleman believed that Jesus could heal his son, but he may have had a couple of flaws in his thinking, because he seemed to be thinking that Jesus had to go to Capernaum to save his son, so there was a limitation that he had in his mind as to what Jesus may or may not be able to do. He didn't think about it being possible for him to do something other than that. And he also communicated his impression that if the boy were to die in the meanwhile, it would be too late and nothing could be done. But it reminds us that we often come to faulty conclusions because we don't see all of the alternatives, or we simply don't grasp the power of God, and that may be part of the equation as well. So sometimes when we look at our circumstances, we can tend to have tunnel vision and we don't see what God could do outside the parameters that we impose in our own thinking, and we need to be cautious of that. And this individual seemed to be one of those as well. So Jesus indicated a concern for the basis of faith. That was his first response. The official was simply responding like most Galileans would have, and Jesus is talking to him, and he uses the plural you when he says you. He's not talking about just this guy. He's talking about the people in that area in general, the Jewish people probably is what he had in mind, indicating that there was a typical element of unbelief of most of the people, and they wanted something tangible, something concrete. We're not much different than that. We kind of want to see some specific things so that we can trust in the Lord. We want to see some evidence. Show yourselves to us is kind of what we want. And there were others in Scripture that communicated the same thing. We tend to be that way. We want to have more tangible proof. If we're going to trust you, give me something to go on. And he says, take my word for it. And we're thinking, I'm not good at that, taking someone's word for it at times. So here Jesus mentions signs and it sort of points to the significance of his miracles, because that's what he had been doing. And this is also the only place in John where the word wonders is used, signs and wonders. That word stresses the wonder or the awe that the miracles would produce in the people who would have seen them. And so Jesus' use of the word suggests that the people wanted to see the miracles just so they could marvel at them, as opposed maybe to have embraced him for who he was. And we know that people tend to be impressed with the spectacular, and they may be bored with the significant. We don't always distinguish those as carefully as we could. Jesus implied that the man did not believe in him. Now, he may have believed that Jesus could heal, but was he actually believing in him for who he was? He didn't apparently grasp that Jesus was able to heal from a distance. He thought he had to be there. So Jesus viewed the second level of belief as the significant one, belief in. We've often distinguished between belief that something is true and belief in someone, as is asked of us with regard to our understanding of who Christ is. Do we believe him? Do we trust in him for our salvation? Or are we trusting in something else? Or we're just believe something about him, that he is something or another. So it's possible that the man may have felt a bit rebuked by Jesus' comment. We wouldn't be surprised because that's kind of what it sounds like to us. But sometimes in English, something isn't quite the same as what it may have been in the original at the time. But it does sound like that because he was making a general statement of the people around him as a whole. And then the question is this more about levels of faith or is it about levels of understanding the object of our faith? Because sometimes we think, well, I just need to have enough faith. Well, the issue is not whether I have a certain quantity or quality of faith as much as it is what is the object of my faith? Am I putting my faith in the right person or in the right object, the object of my faith? That's, I think, the critical element here. Then the nobleman said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus said to him, "Go your way, your son lives." So the man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him, and he went his way. Now that looks simple enough. But what is involved with all of that? So, let's think about the sustaining hope at the point of belief. The official again stresses his desperation in his request. He seemed to have little interest in the reasons why people around him may not believe. He was so focused on his child, his little boy. The term there is paideon, that's child, because he was at death's door. And anyone who's been in that situation can sense that desperation. And so he was communicating that to Jesus in his urgency to ask him to come quickly. And it's down to Capernaum because Cana is up higher elevation, and then you go drop down to Capernaum, which is on the northern side of the Sea of Galilee. And, of course, that's lower by a fair bit. Jesus did not do what the Father asked. Now, have you ever asked the Lord for something and he didn't do what you asked? But he did something different than what you asked? Well, that happens. It happens here. He gave him a promise instead. He said, your son lives. It's okay. It's a done deal. Now, that would take some faith, wouldn't it? Simply taking him at his word. Now, how often do you do that? Do you ever doubt anyone around you? Does your spouse ever doubt you? Well, not in real life. I mean, this is theoretical, right? Yeah, we do at times. Do we have faith to take him at his word without tangible evidence in advance? That's what's being asked here. And that's what's often asked of us. Do we just take him at his word? Do we trust him? Easier said than done, I think. So the official seems to have grasped this promise and departed for home alone, without Jesus, demonstrating that he did believe that Jesus could heal from a distance, that he could go home and find his son alive and well. If he had refused to go home without Jesus, what would he be communicating? That he didn't believe, didn't trust him, didn't take him at his word. And we've probably been there at some point or another. So he chose not to insist on receiving evidence. Remember there was this question of, you got to see signs and wonders before you believe? And here he went without a sign or a wonder, but he went on his way. So that's taking the word of the Lord just as is, as the truth, as the way it is. That's what we need to be reminded of as well. So there's an acknowledgement of divine intervention. Verses 51 to 53. And as he was going down, his servants met him and told him, saying, "Your son lives." Then he inquired of them the hour when he got better. And they said to him, "Yesterday at the seventh hour the fever left him." So the father knew it was the same hour in which Jesus said to him, "Your son lives." And he himself believed in his whole household. So there's something to think about here, the timing of the circumstances. The man would have his faith further deepened. He had believed in the Lord enough to go, and then when he saw that confirmation, it was even more strengthened. And it was a confirmation that it was the Lord, that was Jesus, who had brought this to pass, just as he had said. Because his servants met him on the way back to Capernaum and had good news, and they determined what time it was. It was 1 o'clock, would have been our timing of it, when the event had taken place. So he learned that the condition of his son had not only improved significantly, but it was more than he even may have expected. At the very moment when Jesus had given his promise, this was confirmation that his son's recovery was no accident. It was not just a coincidence. Wow, isn't that just serendipitous that it happened at the same time? No, it was confirmation, which was the intention. That's what John was wanting to communicate in his passing this along to us. The emphasis on the belief that even the man believed and his household believed. They recognized that this was indeed Jesus, the Messiah. It seems that that's what the understanding was. And they learned that Jesus' word was powerful to save even at a distance, which is, you know, interesting as well. One commentator noted that his faith grew from crisis faith, verse 47, to confident faith, verse 50, to confirmed faith, verse 53, to contagious faith, in verse 53. Interesting way to think about it. Ours sometimes needs a little boost as well. And I think that's an interesting observation. So, in reality, his faith was linked to his understanding of the person he was trusting. And that's what it always comes down to, the object of our faith. When we ask someone to believe, they need to know what it is or who it is that they are to be believing in. And then verse 54. This again is the second sign Jesus did when he had come out of Judea into Galilee. So here's a reference. The first sign was the water into wine. This is the second sign that is noted here. The implications of the circumstances. The second sign indicates a connection to the previous sign. So John interestingly called this miracle the second sign that Jesus performed, even though he did other miracles in both Galilee and Judea after he had changed the water to wine. So this is the second of several recorded miracles that John labeled as such in his gospel as signs. So why is he doing that? Because he is using these as a means, as a theme that is tying things together. That is his focus. And so this is pointing to a similarity, a relationship between these particular ones. As we've seen, the structure of this passage is significant in how it's laid out. It shows that There is the first and there is the last. These are the bookends kind of thing that is tying this section together. And again, it's a matter of contrasting the unbelief that had been marked in Judea with the faith that was more prominent in Galilee. And that's, I think, significant. And then we have the geographical signposts that are noted here as well. This miracle had a limited, direct audience. Those that saw it, that heard it, were a very small group, just this main family, at least initially. And it's one that's described a little bit in some detail here. Only the family and the household servants of the official were those that knew it first, but that was sort of typical of Jesus' ministry. He would deal with individuals on an individual level. And then he also performed many miracles publicly, and then there would be huge crowds that would follow him because they had witnessed some event or another, but the impact usually was on a smaller number of people, a few individuals who were genuinely responsive. This section of John's Gospel records Jesus' early ministry, as we have already alluded to, and it contains various witnesses to the identity of Jesus in chapters 2 through 4. This part of John's Gospel is framed by two miracles in Cana with two statements about unbelief by Jesus. Also, there's two evangelistic conversations of Jesus that occur between those miracles. The first sign testified to his creative power to change the quality of things. His cleansing of the temple showed his authority over the institutions of Judaism. Nicodemus testified to Jesus having come from God and his role as an authoritative teacher, which was a common Jewish response to him. He was an authoritative teacher. At least recognize that. Of course, John the Baptist bore witness that Jesus was the Messiah, the one that was anticipated as coming. The Samaritan woman's testimony implied that Jesus was omniscient because he knew all about her. Many of the Samaritans also acknowledged that Jesus was the Savior of the world, which was a common Gentile response to him. And now the official, whose son was healed from afar, came to recognize Jesus as a healer whose word can overcome the problem of distance as well as disease. So the first sign in John's Gospel shows Jesus' power over time. The second sign shows his power over space. John the Apostle also referred to Jesus as the Son of God, the giver of eternal life, the one from heaven. So this section of the book is kind of important in terms of laying a foundation for understanding who he is, how he was presenting himself, how people responded to him, and what responses were appropriate and desirable. So the emphasis is on the idea that you may believe that was communicated in the purpose statement in John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. These things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, and that believing you may have life in his name. So do we have hope in the circumstances of life because we believe in him and take him at his word? Because that makes a big difference. If you don't have any hope for dealing with what's going on in our world today, if you don't know Christ, what are you left with? I mean, it's a pretty hopeless situation. Do we trust him to do what's ever needed, even when he's not physically present with us? That's asking a fair amount, isn't it? But we have good reason to hope and trust in him in all circumstances. even in today's crazy, mixed up world. Let's look to him.